to show you.
Welcome to the 42nd episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm Melissa Megan, and I'm joined tonight by my lovely co-hosts, Jackie DeVore.
Hello.
And Sierra Houck.
Hey there.
Today we're joined by a very special guest, New York Times bestseller writer of The Damned, The Six Gun, Harrow County Regression, and Dark Arc, just to name a few, Colin Bunn.
Hey guys.
We are super psyched to have you on.
I'm super happy to be here.
Yeah, we talk about your stuff quite a bit on the show, and we were super excited that you were able to make some space to come and chat with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
We've got lots and lots of scary stories to talk about tonight, obviously. But first, I thought we'd very quickly mention, how awesome is it that a monster movie won the Oscar for Best Picture this year?
Very cool.
It's so cool.
Yeah, that's kind of great.
It's pretty great. We're big fans of Guillermo del Toro here, so I think it's really important to say congrats to him for both of his wins. How did you guys feel about the winners? Was there anything in particular that you were excited for that you felt was really overlooked?
Obviously, Get Out is the big...
Obviously, yeah. For screenplay. That was super good.
I think Jackie had mentioned Baby Driver, and I completely agree.
Yeah, Baby Driver should have gotten
it. Really should have gotten sound design. The sound design in that was incredible. I hadn't seen...
And just editing in general.
Yeah, I hadn't seen the other movie that actually won. So
Dunkirk?
Was that what it is?
I think
I forgot it already.
I think so, yeah.
Oscars was like more than 24 hours ago, so, you know, who remembers it now?
I was going to say it was super, super lovely to see everybody freaking out and being really happy for Jordan Peele. Yeah. And seeing, like, the pictures of Keegan-Michael Key, like, jumping up and down and being so happy.
We all needed Keegan-Michael Key in our lives.
I know.
I seriously spent the whole next day just looking at adorable pictures of him being happy for Jordan Peele.
Yeah, me too. It was a good break from all the doom and gloom on Twitter.
We had a big conversation in this house about Edgar Wright and, you know, whether, like, does the fact that every one of his movies have incredible sound, does that just mean that, like, it's expected now and so nobody's going to award him for that? And,
oh, maybe.
You know, I mean, yeah, Baby Driver was the best sounding film that I think I heard last year for sure. It was incredible. So, okay. Congrats to Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to say that. I'm really happy to see him. I saw him on, what was it? It was not Jimmy Fallon.
The other Jimmy guy.
Yeah.
Kimmel?
Yeah, I think it was on Jimmy Kimmel. And he was sitting down talking about his win. And the cool thing about El Toro is I think he's just one of the humblest, most genuine guys in Hollywood right now. Mm-hmm.
He looks like that adorable nerd that is constantly surprised that he came as far as he has. And it's so heartwarming.
I think that's kind of what he is. He's just kind of a super fan, right?
Yeah. Have you guys ever seen pictures of his the Bleak House?
Oh my gosh, yes.
His office. I mean, that is what I aspire to. I would love to have that house. Mm-hmm. That is so cool.
I know.
I'm going to have to look
I really wanted to go. Amazing. There is an exhibit in LA for a while of like a bunch of stuff from like Pan's Labyrinth and all that stuff, but then also like stuff from his house that was just like put in because it's so exhibit worthy.
Yeah, there's a couple of books that are basically art books that are nothing but pictures of his house that are something.
And it's
sketchbooks. It's basically a mix of his sketchbooks and his house, and it's pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's just a big super fan, and like every time I've seen him speak, and it, you know, it says something when so many people who have worked with him always comment how great it is to work with him, and how like they're just excited to do anything for him.
Yeah,
because he treats people so well. He was on Jimmy Kimmel, and Jimmy asked him, you know, sort of like, what was the first thing you did after your name was announced? He said, well, after I got my award, I immediately left so that I could change my pants and my shoes. I was like, well, what happened to your pants? You know, did you have an accident or something? He's like, and he goes into this ridiculous description about how he's wearing tuxedo pants and you can't wear a belt with tuxedo pants. And he's like, you know, my belly was kind of, he kept saying my left love handle just kept popping out of my pants and it wouldn't stay. Is there anything cuter than Guillermo del Toro talking about his left love handle?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Trying to change his pants so his love handles wouldn't pop out. It was so cute. So we usually grill our guest a little bit. We decided to skip that part tonight with Colin tonight just because we have so many questions for him that he's just basically going to be grilled for the next 2 hours. So we're going to take it easy on you tonight. We'll jump in and talk about a few recommendations first. Sierra, why don't you get us started on that?
Okay, so the first recommendation I have is a series on Netflix called Occult Crimes. And it's exactly what it sounds
I'm
like.
I'm already into it.
It's really good. The format is that they kind of give you a summation of a crime and like kind of what the detectives and the police come upon at the scene. And then they go back and they talk about a cult leader or a group or some kind of, you know, situation that led up to this crime. And then they talk about how the police kind of like put all the clues together and solved it, and then the aftermath of it. So it gets into this like kind of big crime, usually, you know, murders or suicides or something, but then it goes back and it talks about the cult leader and like the ways that he brainwashed people and like his crazy ego, and get into like kind of the history of his following and all of that stuff. So it's really good. The reenactments are they're only a little silly. They're not too painful. And they have like obviously some footage and news reports and stuff mixed into that stuff too. I think it's a French production. All of the like talking heads are speaking French, and then they have like a dub over it, which isn't too bad. So it's a fun one.
Did you watch any of Dark? Is it better than that?
Like, I haven't watched Dark. No.
The dubbing? Okay.
I think maybe dubbing isn't the right word. It's like how it's like when
like a translation.
Yeah, it's like a translation track over it kind of thing.
Are they dramatic in their translation speech though?
A little bit. There's like little like French sayings like mixed in with it, which is like clearly that's not how we would talk if we were just translating it. But the overall like narration in between scenes is in English, so I'm not totally sure if it was originally made in French and then like redone in English for Netflix or what the deal is there, but it's not distracting or anything like that. And it's kind of actually nice too, because it gets into more like crimes overseas and stuff like that. So it's not like the same stuff that all of these documentary series, like they go over kind of the same crimes over and over again. Right. So it's a couple of things that I haven't heard before. So it's a good watch. The episodes aren't crazy.
There are cheesy reenactments. Yeah.
Yeah. There's like people in like secret layers, like doing sacrifices and awesome. Things in silly costumes. Yeah. Awesome. It's great. Yeah.
I'm in.
But I'm mostly into it because it has the like psychology of these cult leaders and like their crazy egos and like kind of what led up to them becoming like thinking that they are the new like Jesus or, you know, what led to them creating these followings and then ultimately why they thought that they had to commit these crimes.
Okay, yeah, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's good. And among all of the like true crime stuff on Netflix, it's one of the better ones that I've started watching. So, and then the other one I wanted to mention is a website called magic.me. That's magick.me. And this is it's like classes for chaos magic. I heard the guy who created it, Jason Louv, on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And he's this like scholar of chaos magic, and he was like kind of in the like magic scene growing up, and he knows all of the like different players and like has written books about it. So that interview with Duncan Trussell was really interesting. But then he also like has all of these like web seminars about learning how to do magic.
Interesting.
And it's something that I want to do it, but it's also like, I don't know, $40 a class or something. So it's like, I don't know if I really want to.
That's gotta be a tax write-off, right?
Maybe.
I'm looking at it right now. I think I can figure out a way.
They had to do it for work.
That's right.
It's research.
You know, famously, you know, comic writers Grant Morrison and Alan Moore have long been in a magical feud. And isn't Grant Morrison a chaos magician?
I wouldn't be surprised. That sounds right.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
But there's stuff about learning tarot, achieving peak mental and physical energy, the Magician's Workshop, Introduction to Lucid Dreaming, like some of these things are things that we want to do episodes on, or that I at least want us to do episodes on, like doing a tarot episode.
Yeah, we're definitely going to.
Maybe I'll do some of these and then we'll talk about it. Yeah. When we finally get our shit together and do a Patreon, maybe the funds from that will fund my research.
Have that be a tier. Donate this amount per month and we'll send Sierra to magic school.
So really, this is just a selfish recommendation.
I love that term, chaos magic. Like,
I know, I feel like it sounds so mysterious.
I think that's what Max says to my living room every day. I'm just gonna call it chaos magic.
Mm-hmm. He's very powerful.
Like, wait, I cleaned my house. Oh, now it's chaos again. It's chaos magic. Let's see. I guess I'll go next just because I only have one quick thing to share. I'm going to talk about the Frankenstein Chronicles, which is a series on Netflix right now. It apparently, I just found out, it was actually started back in 2015. So it's an old series.
That's
interesting. It's kind of been floating like in purgatory. I guess it was bought by A&E back in 2015 and they got to see it in the UK back then. And then it was greenlit for a second season. And it's been sitting around ever since then, kind of like with A&E not doing anything with it until it finally got passed on to Netflix and they put it out there. But stars Sean Bean, and so far he's still alive. So
about to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, how are they gonna do a show based on this guy? He's not gonna live. But no, he's still alive. So he plays a detective named John Marlotte, and I don't know what the exact time period is. It makes me think, let's say 1800s, London. And he finds a child's body washed up on the shore of a river. And the body is sort of like patchwork together. Frankenstein together. Uh-huh. So he starts this investigation trying to figure out, you know, what happened to this child, where the body parts came from, etc. Brings a lot of different elements into it. It brings in like the whole kind of concept of, you know, where the medical industry was getting bodies at that time, surgeons just becoming kind of a legitimate, recognized, you know, part of the medical industry. Mm-hmm. There's laws that they're trying to pass, laws at the time of the show when it starts, to prevent those bodies from, I think the law they're trying to pass is that anybody who's poor and can't afford a funeral, basically the surgeons are allowed to like claim those bodies and go to medicine. So then there's this whole kind of like, you know, conspiracy aspect to it. Like, who's like, is there somebody behind these children disappearing and this body, you know, that have to do with that law being passed? There's a lot of different like political elements in it. I love things that take place in this period because like everything's so gritty and dirty and gross, you know. Just walking down the street, like everybody's covered in mud and like it's just sloshy and dirty and like everything's very, you know, there's so much smog over the city. Mm-hmm. It's really good. It's definitely a little bit grittier than I expected. And, you know, I think Sean Bean is great and it's really interesting so far. Vanessa Kirby is in it. I don't know if anybody's familiar with her. You know, there's a lot of ladies and lords and sirs and a lot of poor little children with really bad English. And I'm not all the way through the first season yet, but it's really interesting. I think I'd call it a reimagining of the Frankenstein idea. Is what it is. It's not retelling. It's a reimagining of it. So kind of like, but it feels like if you took the story of, you know, Frankenstein's monster and sort of put it into a more realistic setting, like this is what it would look like if people were actually being stitched together and dumped in the river.
Gross.
Yeah. So gross. Jackie, do you want to go next? Sure. Or should we stick Cullen in there?
I just have one. It's Two Girls, One Ghost. It's a podcast that I keep hearing about here and there, so I decided to give it a shot. I don't really listen to a lot of podcasts, so it's a little hard for me to get into something, but I've listened to like four of these episodes in one day, so I guess that's a good sign.
Yeah, that's a pretty good mark.
Yeah. This is basically two girls that are old college buddies that ran into some supernatural occurrences themselves and have been kind of obsessed with it ever since. And they choose a topic every week or so. I don't really know the frequency, But they choose a topic for every episode and come up with their own story for each episode. So, like, one is about haunted inns, and one girl told a story about how this particular inn in her hometown was apparently just, like, dripping with ghosts. And, like, nobody would get near it because they're just, like, ghosts everywhere. Like, ghosts smeared on the doorknob. Like, you don't want to get even, like, near this thing. So they tell these stories, like, recountings of people's experiences with different supernatural phenomenons and different areas, and supposedly they're all true, but you know, that comes with, you have to take that spoonful of doubt.
It's more fun to believe, Jackie.
It is. So it's all true. Every little bit of it is true, for Sierra's sake.
Yeah. we don't want to ruin Sierra's fantasy.
But I was looking for the hole that Ghosts and the Burbs had left for me, mm-hmm. since catching up on that. So I've been listening to this, and it seems to be carrying over pretty well, but I need more ghost stories in my life. Like, I need, like, really creepy ones in my life here.
When I saw that you put this on the list, I subscribed to it, but I haven't started it yet. But I'm also needing one because I think I've talked about it before, the That's Why We Drink podcast, which is one paranormal story and then one true crime story. I've kind of gotten burnt out on that one. And so I need, like, something to fill the void.
Yeah, this one is very lighthearted. Like, you can tell these girls have been friends for a very long time, and it feels very natural, their conversation between each other. So it's not something that's going to, you know, be atmospheric and drag you into this hole of supernatural darkness like some stories, but but it is fun. It's a fun time.
We're not going to talk about supernatural holes of darkness on this show at all.
No, never.
Definitely not.
Colin would never do that to us. Colin, what do you got for us? You have something really interesting I want to hear about.
Yeah, I was trying to come up with some recommendations, and it sounds like you guys have talked about most of the things I was going to recommend before in previous episodes. But I think I came up with one. Last year at the Chicago Comic Convention, C2E2, I stumbled onto this artist who does these little portraits called Cameo Creeps.
Awesome.
And so they come in, you know, they're about, you know, 3 inches, 3 or 4 inches in size, and they come in these little round frame, oval-shaped frames. They look like old classic portraits, and there are portraits of different lords and ladies, only they all are horror-themed. So there's, you know, there's a werewolf and a vampire and a, you know, a Cthulhu-faced lady, and, you know, and they all have interest. There's, I don't know, I think there may be 30 or so of these different characters. It's almost like trading cards of these beautiful little portraits of these monstrous beings.
And
they all have,
you know,
they all have these interesting little names, you know, and
they're very cool. I'm looking at them now.
Yeah, and the artist is a guy named Chris Seaman, and he just does these great little portraits, and to me, when I look at them, they all look like they have an interesting backstory to them.
Yeah, I want to play like you said, a card game or a tabletop game or something with these. That would be super cool.
I asked him when I first discovered these, I asked him if there was something like that in place, and he says they are working on, he told me then they were working on a game.
Nice.
And that they were working on a like a book of stories about the different characters, but they're really neat. They just ran a Kickstarter for like wave 3 maybe or wave 2. But they're super cool little monsters. If you like, I have a bunch of them hanging in my office now, because the only problem with them is I couldn't buy just one. I wanted I wanted the set.
How big are they? They're like wall hangings, right?
Necklace. But they're small. They're like necklace cameo size.
Oh wow!
They're really small. So like on my wall, I have 6 or 7 of them, you know, in a little array that I hung up. But they're very small little paintings, and they're prints, but he puts some sort of a lacquer or something over each one so that it looks like canvas and kind of feels like canvas.
Nice.
But I really like them. If you like sort of goofy looking horrible creatures, there's something about them reminds me of old horror trading cards I used to collect as a kid. And And I think that's why I like him so much.
I love the names too, like Hellfire Demon of Sir Bernard Kingsforge. Yes.
Yeah, there's a like
amazingly sophisticated names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sir Vigil Melton, but his head's made of a candle and he's a melting candle. I'm pretty sure they don't have him on his website, I don't think, but they did like the Golden Girls. They did a set that were different Golden Girls as horror characters that they did for the Kickstarter. And I bought those for my wife.
Nice.
She's a Golden Girls fan.
They're pretty affordable too. They're just 25 each, or the original paintings are only 300, which is like good for an original painting. Yeah.
I haven't bought an original yet, but if he's in Chicago this year, I may buy an original from him.
Looks like they're popular because a lot of them are marked sold out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think they've done really well on, you know, on every time he's run Kickstarters, they've been very successful.
You know, one thing people don't talk about enough when it comes to Comic-Cons is the ability to discover these sort of like quirky little small artists. I love Comic-Cons for that, where you can find people that you haven't heard of or seen before, and then you just start sort of looking all their stuff up online and you discover that they have this whole plethora of amazing store full of cool things that you can get. I've brought a lot of artists on the show before that I found at cons.
And we like it when Melissa goes to cons because she often sends us really cool stuff.
It's true. Yeah.
I get toys for the girls.
I was bummed. Emerald City Comic Con was just this last weekend, but we had like just gotten back from traveling, so I missed it.
Oh yeah, how was Hawaii?
It was lovely. I mean, of course.
Was that your recommendation, Colin?
That's it. That's the only recommendation I have. You guys, you stole
my. That was a good one, though.
It's pretty hard for us to find recommendations these days that one of us haven't talked
about. Yeah, we
need
to like make a really detailed spreadsheet of our recommendations because it's getting out of hand.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we have a treasure trove full of horror stuff that we found in the past year and a half that we've been doing the show. So, all right, we're going to take a real quick break so everybody can get their drinks refilled, etc. And then we're going to come back and we're going to start talking all about Colin Bunn and all of the amazing horror stuff that he is bringing to us constantly.
Sometimes I don't know where the starting road is taking me. Sometimes I don't know the reason why, so I guess I'll keep gambling lots of moves and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just waiting around to die. Well, one time, friends, I had a mind. I even had a bar. He beat her with a belt once, close she cried. She told him to take care of me. She headed down to Tennessee. Well, it's easier just waiting around to die.
We're back, and we've got Colin Bunn with us tonight, and I thought that since we didn't do our usual grill the guest, we would start off kind of talking about some general horror background stuff and kind of get to know where everything comes from for you and sort of where your real passion lies within the huge genre of horror.
Wait, before we jump right into that, can I ask, Colin, where does your amazing Southern accent come from?
It comes from the same place my love of horror comes from, backwoods North Carolina.
Oh, where in North Carolina?
So I grew up, I mean, all around, you know, various areas, but Newton Grove and Goldsboro and Fayetteville, North Carolina, those were the, you know, I lived all around in those areas quite a bit.
Cool. I used to live in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah. And then I moved, I thought I lived out in the country when I lived in Newton Grove and Goldsboro. And then we moved when I was 18, I moved to the Missouri Ozarks and I realized I knew nothing about the country up until that point.
Yeah, at this point on the show, we've kind of got, especially now with Cullen on, we've got like every point of the U.S. covered tonight. So, Cullen, I know this is a tough question because it's so big, but what kind of got you into horror, and how deep does your love for horror really go?
You know, I think a lot about, you know, I get asked that a lot, and I think a lot about it. It goes pretty far back. I mean, I used to say I was never into horror until I was a teenager, but that's not really true, because I was really into, when I was a kid, I was really into ghost stories and stories of strange happenings, and I was obsessed with, I thought Bigfoot lived out in the woods behind our house.
Hell yeah.
Obviously.
And, you know, I was obsessed with witches and UFOs, and I had a Sleepy Hollow record that, strangely enough, came on the back of a cereal box. On the back of the cereal box, it had a record you could cut out and put on your record player. And I used to listen to that thing. Yeah. Yeah, it was a big thing when I was a kid, because I'm apparently ancient. we would cut these records out off the back of cereal boxes, and I played this Sleepy Hollow record endlessly. I was fascinated by it. So, and I remember sneaking in, my older brother and sister were watching Hammer horror movies on like the Late Late Show, and I remember crawling across the floor and watching them from behind the couch because I wasn't supposed to be up.
Yep.
So I've just, I think I've just always, one way or another, have been interested in horror. At some point along the ways, I became less interested in it, and then in my teenage years, I decided I was going to become a special effects makeup artist.
Nice.
And when I decided, and it was all practical effects, so I got into horror movies again, because that's where, you know, that's where I would see myself going. And I got my subscription to Fangoria magazine and you know, those types of things, and got really deep into horror again. And getting into the movies in that way got me into reading a lot more horror, and then it's just been my obsession ever since.
My husband likes to tell a funny story about when he was about 9 years old, he was obsessed with special effects makeup too, and he somehow managed to track down Tom Savini's phone number.
Oh, nice. Shit.
And just like called him very randomly. Just this little kid just called him up and was like, yeah, I just want to talk to you about special effects makeup.
I'm sure he loved that.
I don't think Tom has a good reputation in fandom of being like super friendly with fans. So I think he was kind of nice enough, but very short with him. Like, yeah, okay, kid. Goodbye.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you don't really have the cojones to do that once you're like over 15, right? It's like, yeah.
No, you do. Really, I think some people still do.
Yeah. Who were some of your favorite creators growing up? Did you kind of know early on that like you wanted to do comic book horror stuff? Because that's like a really niche sort of thing in comics. It's become really huge now, but probably when you were young, there were very few horror comics out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, there were a lot of anthology horror comics. I read a lot of that stuff, but I don't think I wasn't as interested in horror comics going in. I read a lot more. I was and still am a huge fan of H.P. Lovecraft's work. And then a number of other writers. I mean, obviously Stephen King, but even more so than Stephen King, I liked, there's a writer named Robert McCammon, who I still think is one of the greatest horror writers who ever lived. He doesn't write horror anymore. He's more into, you know, historical fiction, but he wrote some amazing horror stuff, and I was really into his work. Robert E. Howard, who's best known for Conan, wrote some amazing horror stories that I was obsessed with for a while. Robert Bloch, Joe Lansdale. I mean, there were just so many horror writers. I used to work at Walden Books when there was a Walden Books, and I managed the horror section because it was funny because most bookstores don't have horror sections. They just throw it all into fiction. But we had two wall units of horror books that I curated.
Oh wow!
And we just had, I mean. And it was a very successful section in the store. It was, you know, it just did very well for us because actually someone cared about it and tried to bring in interesting new books for people to read rather than just Dean Koontz. Nothing against Dean Koontz, but rather than Dean Koontz and Stephen King books, there were a few additional things that people just wouldn't, you know, they'd stumble across. They'd discover some new things. And I so many of those writers just meant a lot to me. going into it. And that's where I wanted to be for a while. After I gave up on special effects makeup, I wanted to, you know, write horror novels and things like that, because I didn't know how to get into comics. And I always knew I wanted to tell stories, but I didn't necessarily care what medium I was going to be using.
So what made you give up on special effects makeup?
Oh, I don't know. Well, when I was a senior in high school, I applied to a special effects school. You know, I sent in my stuff for a special effects school that I got, I think, out of the back of Fangoria or something.
Nice.
And that's what I wanted to do instead of college. And my parents, bless them, they were supportive. And then I just got very scared about moving to LA all by myself at 18. And I turned my back on it and kind of pursued other things.
Fair enough.
That's scary. I'd be scared to move to LA now at 40. So.
Yeah, I don't
I don't know how people do that.
It terrified me, and I just gave up on it and focused on other things. Also, I don't know. I'm not sure I was very good. So
that'll get you out of an industry real quick, yes. Right? Just realize that you're not doing well at it.
Yeah, I just knew I didn't know what I was doing. Later in life, I realized that doesn't matter and I can fake it. But at that time, I thought I had to be really good at it. So
do you want to name drop a few people that you feel like are really inspiring you now? Current creators that get your... get your juices flowing a little bit.
Oh, sure. You know, I'm a big fan of Warren Ellis and Grant Morrison. There's something about their work. Even sometimes I don't know that I even understand it, but but there's something about it that inspires me. I like the mayhem of it all, especially Grant Morrison. Okay. His work just has a lot of mayhem that I can really get behind. But you know, I'm also, you know, there, you know, I like Jason Aaron's work a lot. I like Rick Remender, I think, is a huge imagination. And I love how many different kinds of stories he's tackling. And I like that quite a bit. I'm sure, I mean, there's...
He builds a world, like amazingly.
Yes. Yes, he does. And that's the kind of thing I really, you know, I really love is that world building and just ideas and kind of just going out there with some crazy... Rick Remender in particular, I think he just puts it all out there on the page when he's writing these things. I mean, there's some, you can't read a book like Low and it starts out as one type of story and then turns into something completely different because he's just throwing these ideas out there and making them work, which impresses me.
I've got a huge love affair with Low. That's such a great series.
Well, it's, if nothing else, it's just, it's a beautiful book anyway.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and But yeah, it's such a weird book for me because it starts in one, it sort of starts out one way and then turns by the end of the first arc into something completely different.
We've talked a lot on this show on how, like, where the lines cross to between sci-fi and horror, you know, which is a tricky thing sometimes to put a label on.
Yeah.
Because space in itself can often be terrifying, or like, or anything that takes place in the depths of the ocean, even if there's not necessarily a monster, right?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, and you know, a lot of my favorite books, I wouldn't say are horror books even, but a lot of them have horror elements. I think when it comes to comics, at least, I think a lot of them have horror elements.
I would like to hear the story of 8-Ball the Cougar.
How did you know the name? Did I put the name out there somewhere?
You did. You did. And once I saw him, like, I have to know what this is about.
I'm shocked because usually I don't tell people the name until I tell the story. So, okay.
We do our research. We do our research right here.
Apparently you've researched every drunken party I've ever been to and told that story. Well, I'll tell it. It takes a minute or two.
That's all good.
Let's hear it.
So, like I said, when I was 18, I moved to Missouri. And but I still drove back to North Carolina to hang out with my friends every so often, just because that's what you do. And I was staying with a friend of mine named Eric in North Carolina. And one morning we got up early to go somewhere. Eric lived out in the middle of nowhere. His front yard, you know, butted up to a highway like something out of Pet Sematary. And then, you know, there were a few barns around his house and some other houses further back. But mostly he was pretty secluded. And one morning I was getting up, we were all getting ready to go, and I came out and Eric was on the phone by his patio door. And I thought it was odd because it was 6 a.m. in the morning and he's talking on the phone. It just seemed strange to me. And he waved me over and he said, Cullen, come here, come look at this. I went to the patio door and there was a cougar walking back and forth around on his patio in the backyard. So I watched it for a while and I was like, wow, that's amazing. A cougar. I've never seen one, you know, out free in the wild, whatever. And then I left and went on about my business. A few seconds later, Eric called me again. He said, Cullen, come here. He said he was on the phone with the police trying to find out what you do when there's a cougar in your yard.
Yeah, I feel like you're not as upset about the cougar enough in this story.
Yeah, I wasn't upset about the cougar. So Eric called me back over. He said, Cullen, come here. The cougar ran off. Go outside and don't let it get in the highway. So, being an 18-year-old and pretty much stupid, I said, okay. And I went outside to find the cougar.
Did you run out there with like a red cape to flash at him or something?
I just walked out all by myself to find this cougar. So I walked around Eric's house and saw no sign of the cougar. Walked around by the highway, still no sign of the cougar. And then I got back around, you know, once I had circled all the way around Eric's house, I was standing midpoint between Eric's house and an old tobacco barn. And Eric's patio door was cracked open so I could call to him. And as I look back at the tobacco barn, I see this cougar. And it was hunched down, its eyes as big as pie plates, and its tail was just whipping back and forth. And it was looking straight at me.
This is the point when I remember you're still alive because you're telling us the story.
Right? Yeah. So I called Eric and I said, Eric, I see it. And he yelled back, good. And I looked back and the cougar was still there. And I said, Eric, it's watching me. And he said, just don't let it go anywhere. And I looked back at the cougar. And this time when I look back, it's running full speed straight at me.
Oh, no.
Dirt Jesus. Coming up from under its feet. And I just yelled, Eric, it's running at me. I turned back and the cougar, about the time, it was just a few yards from me and it leapt into the air straight at me. And I knew I couldn't outrun it. So I just held my arm out, straight out, to try to like strong arm it back. Cougar landed on me with all 4 feet, threw me into some bushes. What? And it was on top of me. And I figured, well, this is it. This is how I die. And I realized it wasn't biting me. It was just sort of gumming me with the side of its mouth.
Oh, jeez.
And I also realized, if you ever have a cat, cats like to jump on you and you know, grab you and they like to tackle you. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what this cougar was doing. It was just playing with me. It jumped off of me. And after that, it just hung out with us. It just sort of crawled around. It jumped on me about 6 more times before, you know, took care of it. But it purred like a kitten.
Aww.
It rubbed up against you. It would rub up against you like a kitten. You know, a kitten will rub up against you and stuff. It would do that. And then occasionally it would jump on me and try to tackle me. And what I found out was in North Carolina, you can own a cougar up until the time it is 18 months, I think, 18 months old. And this cougar was owned by a kid I had gone to high school with. And had gotten out of its pen or whatever he kept it in. And it was an 18-month-old cougar, was getting ready to have to be donated to a zoo. And its name was 8-Ball. But that, you know, it's just a very friendly, great cat.
It's amazing that you stood there just, like, watching the progression of the cougar and relaying the information back to your friend. Instead of running.
At that point, I mean, I knew that if I ran, it was going to chase. It would have chased me down. There's no way I could have outrun this animal.
Well, that's more sense than I would have had in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also keep in mind I did wander outside to find a cougar.
That's true.
So I can't say.
Not the smartest point in time for you.
But he was very friendly. I think about that cougar often.
That's kind of awesome. I mean, you were pounced on by a cougar in the wild, and just to find out he was essentially a giant house cat.
Yeah, he really was. He was just a big cat.
Just somebody's friend. So this story might not be as much fun, but we have to ask about this. Your Twitter bio says one-time world's youngest hypnotist.
Yes. So when I was a kid, my dad was a professional hypnotist.
What?
And he did it. he did it for fundraising, and he was one of those guys. He gets up on the stage and makes people do stupid things. You know, that's his, you know, that's his, that was his gimmick. At some point during his act, I only vaguely remember this, he would call out, he was going to say, now we're going to bring out the world's youngest hypnotist. And I would come out on stage and I would give his subjects carrots, and I would tell them that the carrots were cigars, and they would try to light the cigars with a lighter. And that was the whole, that was my whole bit, according to that, is I would come out, I would try to make them light carrots as cigars, and then I would do a little bow and I'd wander off the stage. But yeah, so that's in that respect, I was the world's youngest hypnotist for a very short period of time. I performed as world. I don't know that any other hypnotist has ever performed at 3 or 4 years old, though. So I may still be world's youngest hypnotist.
Have you ever tried to like pull out your dad's tricks and see if you could actually hypnotize somebody? Or
could I? No. Look, I've tried, yeah. But no. I couldn't do it. I never pulled it off successfully. I think I had a lot of people who would really fake being hypnotized when I'd try. Mm-hmm. But no, I was never much of a hypnotist. He was the hypnotist, and I saw him do some very bizarre things in his time as a hypnotist.
Like what?
Well, so he used to past life regressions, mm-hmm. where he would take people back to, you know, he'd back them up in time until they were 10 years old and 5 years old and 2 years old. And then he'd take them back further and further into other lives that they had lived. And I can just say, I get the, you know, the argument against it is, well, it's just their imagination of what they, you know, what they imagine their life was, you know, in these past lives. But I saw people speak in languages they did not speak before that moment, speaking with different accents, describing how to bake bread, you know, in the 1400s, you know, what their process was of baking bread and going about their daily chores. And just really the detail that these people would get into was fascinating to me.
Hmm.
And I write a book called Regression for Image. And that's really where that book comes from. That's what inspired that book, is all these past life regressions that my dad used to do.
There's so many books to talk about, but at this point, I'm like tempted just to talk about some interesting stories.
That may be it. Those are my two interesting things: a cougar and a dad who could hypnotize people.
Sierra, do you want to talk to him about?
Yeah. So in preparing for this, I got onto your Patreon, and I really liked Squish's story.
Oh.
That I think you posted, yeah, like last October or whatever. Right. How has it been sharing horror with him?
You know, it's nice. He's interesting because he's 9 years old, and he's always been, he's always like creepy stuff, but he's skeptical of it and not super. He doesn't want jump scares.
Right.
So I took him, I took him to a haunted house in San Antonio, last year. He didn't like that very much. But he likes talking about creepy things, and he likes hearing stories about creepy things. And he'll even watch some creepy shows. Mainly, he likes the documentary shows that are, you know, documentaries of creepy things he likes. But he also likes, like, the Goosebumps books, which, you know,
it's
fun because,
who wasn't?
Right? And he likes scary stories to tell in the dark, yeah, because it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things he'll watch with, you know, like we watch, there's a show called Hellevator.
Oh my gosh. And, we love Hellevator.
He loves, yeah, Hellevator. You know, yeah, that he
twins.
Loves, yeah, he loves, yeah, it. He loves watching these other people get scared, but he doesn't want to be scared himself, but he enjoys, the idea of scary stories and things like that. So occasionally he'll write a little scary story. He's written a couple of scary stories for me.
That's excellent.
He's not as, you know, he's not as into, you know, as a parent, I want my kid to be into the things I'm into, which means he's not right. going to be. But mm-hmm.
so he's
not into comics, and he's not, you know, he has no interest in my action figure collection. I think I have more toys than he does because he's not into toys. You know, it's that, you know, it's a it's weird for me what kids are into now and what they're not into, because it's so very different from when I was a kid. But so I get rewarded by these little things that he's interested in, that, you know, these little things I can share, like, you know, Hellevator, which it's odd that that becomes a father-son bonding, you know, bonding show, but that's our bonding show. We can watch Hellevator together.
I want to ask Colin, I have a 5-year-old and he's still obviously young enough that I can just make him a little mini copy of me. So he still thinks everything is cool that we think is cool, but what's the cutoff for that? How much longer do I have before
I don't know
before he doesn't like my stuff
anymore?
I don't
know, because I don't know that my son's ever liked my stuff. I mean, he likes me, but he's never been into the things I'm into. I mean, he likes Star Wars, which, you know, of course I love Star Wars when I was a kid, but he's never been as impressed as I would want him to be. Years ago when he was in kindergarten, I wrote one issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles based on the new animated show, because one, I thought the new animated show was really great, and two, I thought he loved it, so I thought it would really impress him if I wrote an issue of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Sure.
His school had it might have been the Halloween party or something, or the fall party or whatever it's called now, and I took all the kids in his class a copy of this Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles issue. And I remember his teacher asked him, said, "Jackson, do you want to tell everybody what's special about this comic book?" And he said, "Yeah, it has the Ninja Turtles in it." I was like, "Well, thanks."
He tried so hard. So obviously there's tons and tons of work of yours to chat about here, but we're definitely going to focus on horror.
Sure.
You already know that. We'll skip over a lot of the superheroes and all that sort of stuff. I guess we should jump right into the one that we know is a big spotlight right now, which is Harrow County. We did an episode on Harrow County back in September of 2016, and the story has grown so much since then, taken off. And I think this week marks the start of the final story arc for Emmy. Right.
Yeah, that does come out this week. I forgot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have 4 more issues and then before the series ends with issue 32.
That was totally coincidence, too, because I think at the time we scheduled this, I wasn't aware.
Yeah, we kept it pretty secret. We've been working towards issue 32 for a while, but we never wanted to announce when it was ending, because we never know how that's going to affect sales on a book one way or the other. And, you know, it's for stupid marketing reasons, yeah. But We were just very, we played that very close to the vest.
How does it feel to be coming up on the close of this town full of witches and haints that you and Tyler have been doing for 3 years now?
It's kind of scary and it's sad. It's also rewarding. I've always said that I think the very best stories have an ending you can tell on your own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't, you don't always get that in comic books.
I was just about to say that. You don't always get that in comics.
You know,
yeah.
I've worked on a lot of comics and I think I've gotten, you know, the ending on my terms a couple of times. And, you know, we get that with Harrow County. Looking at the issues, I'm very pleased with how we're wrapping it all up and how the story ends. But it's very, you know, it's sad to leave these characters behind and know that their story is coming to an end. It's tough to say goodbye to them, because you grow very attached to, you know, if you do it right, you grow very attached to these characters. And I've definitely, with Harrow County, I'm attached to several of the characters in a big way.
Yeah,
we are too.
We are too. I could see where you'd want to have control over the ending of the story to have it happen the right way and not be one of those comics that has to be, you know, rushed and wrapped up.
And it's just the nature of comics that you don't always get that, because you don't know if the comic's going to sell. If you plan for 100 issues and then the book gets canceled at 50, then you've kind of, you know, tripped yourself up. But with Harrow, I think I asked Tyler maybe while we were working on the first arc, how many issues he would be willing to draw, and we kind of settled, you know, somewhere in the mid 30s. So we then we just outlined the series with that in mind.
Speaking of Tyler, we think his work is absolutely amazing,
mm-hmm.
and I love the in-process videos that he's been doing. I've been following those for a while, the time-lapse. It's really fun to actually watch him work and watch him build the layers on top of that. Can you talk about kind of what your relationship is like with him and how that came to be? How did you guys get together?
Yeah, so I met Tyler while I was working on a book called The Sixth Gun for Oni Press, and we were going to do a couple of fill-in issues where my the regular artist, Brian Hurt, was not going to be drawing those issues. And we knew Tyler from a book he did called Petrograd. And we were fans of his work. He did, I guess it was three fill-in issues for us for The Sixth Gun. And then he did like a mini-series, a three-issue mini-series for The Sixth Gun that I wrote. And that sort of started our relationship as collaborators. We really liked working with each other. And then we did like a six-page story for Dark Horse's Creepy magazine.
Mm-hmm.
We did like a short horror story for that. And then somewhere along the lines, Tyler was doing a lot of work for Dark Horse, and they asked him if he wanted to work on a creator-owned book. And they recommended me as the writer for that book. So Tyler and I started talking about what we would do together. We just hopped on the phone and started spitballing ideas. And at some point during those conversations, I sent him the first 8 chapters of this novel I had started writing. At the time, it was called Countless Haints. That was Harrow County. So he read that, he liked it, and we started about talking about how what we would do to adapt Countless Haints into a comic book series. And that's really where Harrow County came from and how that all came about.
You've worked with a lot of artists, a ton of artists. is there like a dream artist out there right now that you would like to work with, if you could kind of just stick your finger on somebody and say?
I would love to work with Art Adams on something. A lot of the classic artists, you know, people that I grew up really loving, Art Adams or Alan Davis. Both of those are artists I would love to do something with. But, you know, there's so many artists out there I'd want to work with. Dan Barrington, who does a book called The Nocturnals. I've worked with him once, but it wasn't a good experience. Not because of him. It was just a bad editorial experience. It kind of turned the book into a nightmare. And I would love to have a chance to work with him on something that wasn't a nightmare in a bad way, because he's a great horror artist. But there are so many artists I would probably love to work with. It's tough to list them all.
Yeah, I almost feel like comic book art has made this big transition. And I don't know, maybe like the past 6-7 years, feels like, into a lot of it feels more like fine art.
Well, I think, yeah, now. I think you're right. And I think a lot of that is it comes for people are doing their own thing now more than they were in the past. And I think it's not necessarily assembly line art. It's these are artists who want to, you know, who want to tell their own story, if it's creator owned, or put their own, you know, a very important mark on characters, you know, other characters that they may not own. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's taken some huge leaps forward.
Yeah, you had mentioned Lowe earlier, you know, and talking about like Greg Tocchini's work. Is if I had seen that kind of art when I was, you know, 15, I probably would have started reading comics
right,
a lot earlier.
Right.
It's just so gorgeous. So I'm going to throw in a couple of our listener questions here, because obviously we got a lot of questions about Harrow County. And I sort of looked at this and was like, I can come up with endless number of questions about Harrow County, but we talked about it quite a bit on the show, and we have a lot of people that want questions, and there's a lot of other things that you've been working on that I want to make sure we talk about too. So I'm not sure how much you can give to this one, but at Gothic Witch asked if you could tease what the last arc of Harrow County has in store for Emmy and Bernice's friendship, and do you have a sequel or a spinoff planned after Harrow County?
Boy, those are two questions I can't. Those are tough questions.
I didn't expect much from this
last
one.
The last arc of Harrow County was really, really mean to Emmy. I mean, it was a rough story for her. And I'd love to tell you that the next arc's going to take it easy on her, but it's not. It's going to be, you know, there's still dark days ahead for Emmy, and there's some big changes for her. You know, the entire series has been building up to this concept of this witch Hester Beck returning from the dead. And now she's back, and it's going to be just as awful as Emmy has always thought it would be. Bernice, in particular, means a great deal to both me and Tyler. She has quickly become our, I'm speaking for Tyler, but I'm pretty sure she's both his favorite character and my favorite character. But that doesn't mean she's safe, because I'm often the meanest to my favorite characters. That's usually the ones who get it the worst. But, you know, I can't tell you much more beyond that. The last arc showed that nobody in the series is safe, and I think this next arc is going to cement that, and we're just going to show it's Emmy will not get through this story unscathed in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she hasn't yet, right?
Right. And as far as
my heart,
you know, as far as spinoffs, it all depends on how the series ends. You know, Tyler and I have definitely talked about, you know, what's next, and what we would do, you know, as our follow up project, and we're working on some things, but I can't say that it's a Harrow County sequel, so to speak, although I wouldn't necessarily rule that out in the future as well.
Did you want to add something, Sierra?
Oh, I'm just saying I need to prepare myself for this final arc. Oh, yeah. My heart.
Yeah, that sounds like we're going to have to be emotionally prepared.
Steal myself, you know, a little bit.
The story has always, that's not being honest on my part. At some point, the story became about the friendship between Bernice and Emmy. That became mm-hmm. sort of the big focus, and that will remain a big focus in the, you know, in the final arc.
Which actually perfectly answers the next question I had lined up for you from Signot. Says, Bernice and Emmy's friendship is one of my favorite aspects of the book. Did you always plan to have Bernice take on more of a role and learn hedge magic?
You know, no. Initially, she was just going to be a supporting character, but I think almost as soon as we put her in the book, we just gravitated to that character. It wasn't in the beginning that we planned for her to learn hedge magic, but it was fairly early on. Once we realized the book was going to go past an arc, then we had to start thinking about what was going to be next and what, you know, where the series might go. And as we started doing that, that's when this idea of Bernice learning magic and becoming sort of a witch in her own right became part of the mm-hmm. story.
I remember us talking about that on the show back in 2016 over, like, you know, how do we think their relationship is going to change, and are they going to have to go head to head against each other, with no idea back then to what level that was actually going to happen.
And, you know, and of course they do. And I think Tyler would tell you this, and I would say that arc, forget all the other arcs where terrible things happen to Emmy, that arc where Bernice and Emmy were poised against each other was brutal for us. We hated it. I mean, we hated working on it because it was, mm-hmm. we were just uncomfortable the whole time because we knew they shouldn't be fighting like that. We did not enjoy them fighting like that. I know Tyler did not enjoy drawing it, but again, it's just because, you know, we didn't want them to be fighting. We wanted them to be friends.
Yeah. Emma Frost at The White Queen, she asked about the finale of Harrow County, which you've already talked about quite a bit, as much as you can. But I think she also asked, who's your favorite hero and villain in Harrow County? Do you consider Bernice a hero of Harrow County?
Yeah, Bernice is a hero. And I guess, you know, like I said, she's my favorite character in the book. So I guess she's my favorite hero. Although Emmy's very close. You know, I love both of them very much. In Harrow County, my favorite villain is going to be Cammy. Anytime it comes up, because I feel like she's just such a, one, she's awful, but two, mm-hmm. she's just so, she's kind of tragic in a lot of ways. I kind of feel sad for Cammy, and there's something about her that makes me sad, and I just mm-hmm. like that about her.
There's constantly that question, right? Yeah. Of like, would she have been different under different circumstances?
Right. Yeah, it was, you know, nature versus nurture. And with Cammy, that's one thing that I always wish that we'd spent a little more time with Cammy early on, like in the first couple of arcs. You know, I wouldn't have mind spending a little more time with her.
So Emma Frost also asked if you can tell us anything about the Harrow County TV series, how accurate it will be to the story, or, you know, anybody that's in the show, blah, blah, blah. I think that's a lot of information that you probably can't share yet.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot I can tell you about it. I can tell, you know, there's a lot of activity on it right now. A lot of discussion about it. As far as accuracy to the comic, I think there are definitely changes, but they're not. It's still very true to the comic. And that's about as much as I can actually get into it.
That's still so exciting.
Yeah. Very exciting. Especially when you hear so much talk about so many different comic book projects being turned into series and TV shows and movies and, you know, they never come to fruition. So.
Well, yeah. I mean, and look, it, you know, who knows? It's always, you know, I believe it when I see the credits, when I see the credits roll. But it's, you know, it is definitely moving along. Just those wheels can move slowly sometimes.
TV is a fickle beast. So I've got one more for you from a listener that I think is actually a pretty great question. This is from at Rick Rags. He says, Harrow County is incredible and I've read every issue. In your opinion, why does horror resonate with so many people? And why is it even more potent if the horror takes place in a sleepy country town?
The why, you know, why horror is kind of a weird question, and I think I answer it differently every time I answer it. But for me, I think if we're looking at it from a, you know, sort of a good point of view, horror it gives you a chance to see the world through, you know, to see no matter how bad the world is, there's a, you know. There, horror tells stories about people who are trying to triumph over just awful, awful odds. Whether they succeed or fail doesn't necessarily matter. It matters is that we like to see people try. I think that can be part of it. And then from the other side of the coin is, no matter how bad your life is, horror stories kind of show you some people who have a worse life than you at that time. So you can get behind that. You know, I've heard some people say, sort of describe it as watching horror stories or reading, you know, watching horror movies or reading horror stories is kind of a way that we can ward ourselves from these terrible things happening to us. And I think there's something to that. I think that's part of the reason we like them so much. And as far as backwoods, if you've ever been out in the woods at night, and I'm talking the real woods where there are no street lights, it is insanely dark, and there are so many strange noises, and it's just, I don't know. Look, I grew up in the country with all those stories and all these weird happenings. And I think it's just, it lends itself to sort of this super, you know, it lends itself to superstition. It lends itself to seeing strange, you know, strange shapes in the night. And it just helps to sort of heighten that. And it heightens the sense of isolation in when you're telling a backwoods story. And there's no cell phones. Cell phones have been the death of modern horror.
I lived, I spent about 15 years in Florida, and for quite a while I lived in North Florida, and there was some of the noisiest, yet, I don't know, just creepiest sounding nighttime in North Florida that I've heard, because everything was sort of like, you know, we were surrounded by these canals everywhere. So if you walk out of your house at night, you hear gators, you hear frogs, you hear, you know, weird kind of buzzing and strange bugs and water running and all kinds of, it was just a weird, creepy sort of, you know,
and there opera are things of out there sounds. That will eat you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And just like, and such a different kind of blackness too, I think.
Shadows play tricks.
Because,
on you
know, yeah, when you're in a space where like everything's very flat, especially in Florida, there's really no mountains. So it's like there's this huge sky of stars above you. And then everything below that is these like giant cypress trees that just make everything black. And you can't see anything a few feet in front of you, which I think is different too. You know, when you're in the backwoods of a mountain, that's a different kind of creepy. because there's so many different terrains. And
well, and like I said, that's why so many of my stories take place there, is just I just feel like it's a, it heightens that sense of isolation and dread and superstition. And I just think it's a more interesting setting.
We've talked about quite a few stories, I think, on this podcast that take place in, you know, like good Southern Gothic horror, like witches, you know, and just like, it really just takes like some good trees, a nice forest, and you have the makings of a terrifying story. Sierra, do you want to talk to Colin for a minute about Passage in Black? I think we can move off Horror County for a while.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to get my hands on this book yet. I'm super excited to. And I wanted to ask you about what it's like writing short stories, and how it has been publishing that book.
You know, it's been interesting. You know, Passage in Black is definitely a labor of love type of project, because it traces short stories I've written, you know, pretty much to the earliest point in my career as a writer. Some of the earliest stories I ever wrote, and especially wrote for publication, are in that book. And I love horror novels, but I think horror short stories are really where it's at when it comes to prose. Mm-hmm. I think they're just, I feel the same interesting
way. Yeah, and when it's good, it's so good.
Yeah, I think that there are just, I love short stories. I think they're difficult to write, but I do genuinely love that, you know, that type of work. And that's what this book is about. It's just, it's all the short stories I've written over the years. A lot of them written when I had no idea how to get into comics. So I just decided to forget comics and focus on prose. And a lot of those short stories in this book are from that, you know, from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all illustrated by Tim Mayer. Every story's got an illustration along with it, which is awesome. There's a hardcover limited edition that has a special cover by Tyler Crook. So it's just a fun book. And it actually, working on that book, putting it together, has gotten me interested in short stories again and doing more with it. So I'm already starting to collect books. I don't know, in another 20 years, I'll do another sequel to A Passage in Black. Nice.
That's such good news. I'm so excited to read it. I just didn't get my shit together in time for this.
Yeah, it's a, you know, like I said, when I look at it, there's a few of those stories I read and I'm like, ooh, I'm like, oh, I can't believe I wrote that. But I like to think I've improved. And as you read the book, you'll see the books aren't put in they're not in chronological order, but I think you can see sort of a progression in the type of stories I was writing and the things I'm interested in as you read it.
And speaking of short stories and your progression into comics, I wanted to mention Death Follows, which is a big favorite of mine. I think that book says so much in a small package. There's so much going on in that little story. Would you share kind of like how that ended up happening, sort of moving from the web story into the published graphic novel?
Well, Death Follows was actually, it was not a web story. Harrow County was a web story, but Death Follows was a prose. It was just a short story, or more of a novella than a short story. It was just a long short story that I did. And The Remains was the title of the short story. Oh, but you're right. No, I take it back. I think I misunderstood the question.
It was published online first, yeah, right?
I forgot that we published the comic online.
Right.
But what I did, you know, Death... All right, so... I'm not a complete idiot. Let me explain why.
I'm fact-checking you on your own information.
So I got confused because I forgot that Death Follows was released through Monkey Brain Comics online.
Mm-hmm.
But Death Follows was originally a short story that I had written, a prose short story called The Remains. I adapted it into a comic that was on Monkey Brain. And I can't believe I had forgotten that until right then. I'm just so hung up on the graphic novel now, but
it's kind of gone through like three transitions.
It's gone through several phases in its existence. Yeah, doing it online was fine. I don't think enough. I felt like it didn't get the attention I wanted it to get, and we even sold it cheap online. you know, it was it was not expensive to get online, but it didn't get a lot of attention. And I thought that was a tragedy. One, I really loved the story, but I also I felt like people were missing out on Ariel Zamudia. Her work is just, I mean, she's one of the most exciting artists I've seen in many years. I think she is amazing, and it shows in that story. So I felt I was kind of let down that it didn't get the attention that I wanted it to get. And that's why I took it to Dark Horse for the print edition and doing the graphic novel. We did rename it. It was called The Remains, but we had to retitle it to Death Follows because Dark Horse had a book called The Remains already by Steve Niles.
I think it still doesn't get the attention that it deserves, to be honest. I'm constantly pushing this book on people.
You know, it's a weird book because it is all self-contained. That's all there will ever be. And I think to some degree that's easy to get overlooked because it doesn't have a continuing shelf presence. You know, it's not always out there. But I always, you know, at conventions, I a lot of people buy them from me when I set up at conventions only because it's I think if you like horror, it may be the truest horror story I've done in comics. I mean, it's not a story that can be, you know, passed off as a dark fantasy or, you know, a gothic fairy tale or anything like that. It's a horror story, hands down. I think for horror fans, it's definitely a book they should check out because it's dark and it's mean and I think there's quite a few interesting messages I was trying to get across in it. It became more interesting actually when it became a comic because as a short story, the protagonist was a boy.
Wow.
And AC, when she started working on it, we started talking a lot about the protagonist. And I think she might have been the person who recommended, hey, what would you think about making the protagonist a teenage girl instead of a boy? And I feel like it just changed the story in such an amazing way to look at it from that point of view.
It added a whole different level of icky to it. That's for sure.
Oh, it was, believe me, it became super icky and there were plenty of times writing it that I felt kind of grossed out by the whole thing. But in the end, I was very pleased with the result. And like I said, I love Ariel's art so much.
Yeah, she has a very unique style.
Yeah, she's great. I have over my desk, I have a page. There's a scene in the comic where the main character envisions this traveling man as getting his hands caught in a tractor engine, and he gets kind of pulled into the tractor engine. And I have that page hanging over my desk because
nice. Looking at that one right now, it's very bloody.
Yes, it's a bloody page.
Yeah, no, this one, this book, I think I like this self-contained ones like this sometimes because, you know, my other show is all comic show, and I get a lot of people asking like where to start. You know, if I want to read some comics, where should I start? If you're a horror fan, like a little self-contained book like this is perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it feels to me very sort of like Tales from the Crypt. You know, like it's very like classic yeah. scary story stuff.
Yeah, and it's not a story that can continue. I mean, that story is told in that.
Thank God.
Scary. Yeah, that story is told there. But yeah, I apologize for misunderstanding the question.
It's okay.
I kept thinking Harrow County I had published online because I did originally. Harrow County I was doing a sort of a serialized novel online, and I had just completely forgotten that the comic for Death Follows was released on Comixology for a little while.
I could have been more specific and referred to Monkey Brain.
I realized I realized my mistake. You were completely clear.
So also in the vein of talking about classic horror, can we just mention Pumpkinhead? Because that is awesome already. It's so good.
Yes.
How fun has it been resurrecting that character? Like, that I haven't heard about Pumpkinhead in a long time.
Yeah, it's been pretty great. I heard that Dynamite had the license to Pumpkinhead while I was at San Diego this past year. I emailed them as I was walking down the street. I jumped on my phone and emailed the editors that I knew at Dynamite, and I just said, hey, I don't know if you found your writer for Pumpkinhead yet, but you have found your writer, and it's me, because I love Pumpkinhead. I love Pumpkinhead so much. It was one of my favorite movies. I saw it in the theater on opening weekend, and I've always been such a huge fan of that movie that I couldn't wait to do something, do something with it.
My bonding thing with my dad was actually horror movies, and Pumpkinhead's one that I remember as a kid seeing, probably too young. I should have seen it, but that character is still stands as like one of the most unique horror film characters.
Yeah, no, he's
a great monster.
Yeah, he's a great monster. You know, the design on the creature was amazing, but the movie itself, look, a lot of negative things can be said about the acting in the movie, but
it was the 80s.
Yeah, but the visuals of it were so sharp. Everything sort of was seen through this strange sort of filter of blues and reds that gave it a real creepy, creepy feel. And the sound effects were awesome. This insect sound effect that would follow Pumpkinhead around. And I've always been a fan of that monster. So I'm super, I was super excited to do something with it. And
it's got to be fun.
And I like the idea of vengeance being this sort of unsatisfiable need. You get vengeance. It's never enough. Getting vengeance is never enough. And I like that notion.
Sierra, I'm going to throw this one to you because I'm not familiar with this. She wanted to talk to you about If I Knew Then collection.
Yeah, on your website, I really appreciate that you have a page of just all of the If I Knew Back Then, things I wish I knew then kind of advice for getting started in comics or just as an artist. And I know that a lot of our listeners are creative in one way or another, either as artists or writers. And if there's anything that might be echoed on that list that you want to share with them.
I haven't looked at that list in a long time. But, I was just thinking the other day about expectations, my expectations getting into comics and how different it really is, mm-hmm. First of all, it took me forever to get into comics. I always loved comics from early childhood. I was reading comic books, but I had no idea how to break in. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know how to do it. I was painfully shy. I didn't like talking to people. I definitely hated, sort of talking to people cold, like introducing myself, and that it was a huge problem for me, still is, at the time I was breaking in, it was awful. And I was just thinking about what I expected out of comics and what I expected about breaking in and how things are different, and the answer to that is everything. All of my expectations were wrong. And every expectation I think that any would-be creator has, expect the unexpected kind of thing. It's mm-hmm. all of it's going to be different than what you thought. I thought when I published my first comic book, The Damned, that once I did that, that was my ticket. Mm-hmm. I would never have to work a day job again because that book would open so many doors. And I published my first book, and it opened no doors. I couldn't get people to read it, and readers were reading it, but I couldn't get editors to read it. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, when I get my second book out, that will open up, doors, and that didn't happen. And I thought, well, when I get my third book out, that'll open doors, and that did. At that point, it started to, some doors started opening. And then I thought, once I start working for Marvel and DC, everything's going to be great, and everyone's loved my creator-owned stuff, so they're going to love my Marvel and DC stuff too. And that was absolutely not the case. It was a shocking revelation, the difference in readership and expectations from readership between, doing sole creator-owned stuff and doing work-for-hire stuff for Marvel or DC. You just have a different fan base, and there was a great learning curve for me between those two fan bases. I was working a day job and writing for Marvel, and I remember saying, "There's no way I will ever be able to write full time. There's no way I can afford doing it." And 3 weeks later, I was writing full time, but I never expected to be able to. I never expected that I was going to write the X-Men, and I was writing X-Men. And then once I was writing X-Men and Deadpool, I thought, hey, easy street. That'll never change. I know that I'll be writing X-Men and Deadpool for the rest of my days. And that is not the case. It's a series of curveballs and big changes, and just it's definitely a roller coaster of emotion and sadness and anger. And today actually is my 7th anniversary as a full time writer.
Well, happy anniversary!
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yay.
And but I cannot say that anything that's happened in those 7 years I expected. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything that I did expect, I was wrong. And there's just, you just kind of got to be willing to ride that whirlwind a little bit and go for it. I can say this for creative people, and I say this a lot. A very successful writer once sent me a very kind email when I was desperately trying to break in. And the email was just very simple. You know, it said, if I can do this, anyone can do it. And that's the way I feel. I feel like if I can do it, anyone can do it. You just have to, but I can't say it was ever easy for me. I mean, I worked and worked and worked to get where, you know, to get into writing comics and to get to a point where I could make it my full-time job. And now 7 years in, on my 7th anniversary of writing comics full-time, I'm looking at changing everything in the next 12 months. I mean, mm-hmm. I will, you know, I think I'm looking down the barrel of everything that I have been doing up until this point. I'm going to it's going to be changed and different going
that
forward.
That sounds ominous.
In good ways.
Okay.
Good but but no, it's good ways. It's just, I don't think, I think complacency is an enemy of creativity, yeah. And I think mm-hmm. to some degree I've gotten complacent. When you get complacent, you know, it can be comfortable at times, and that can be a good feeling. But the thing is, when you get complacent, sooner or later something's going to come along and shake everything up, and you got to be ready. You know, you don't ever want to be so complacent that you're not able to adapt.
Right.
It seems like you could say, you know, similar things in most industries, I think, too, that, you know, the way that you approach your career and kind of what you want your career to be is going to morph and change through the years.
Absolutely.
So
yeah,
it's almost like you're ready for like a rebuild, right?
Yeah. It's
at this point in your career.
Yeah, it's you know, it's time to expand my horizons and do some different things. And you know, I'm never going to turn my back on comics. I'm always going to be doing comics. But it's you know, I've never done, for instance, a Kickstarter for a comic, and I'm probably going to do a Kickstarter for a comic. There's things like that that I would like to try, and you know, I'd like to experiment with a little more than I would have in the past.
Just don't turn your back on horror, because we really like what you're doing.
Well, I'm never going to... Well, that's the other thing, is chances are I'm always going to be writing horror comics. I mean, it's
okay.
Most of my creator-owned stuff is horror-based, and that will never change.
Yeah, that's one thing we definitely realized about you, was the original characters that you come up with are mostly horror, which is very... It calls to us. It speaks to us.
Yeah. It beckons.
Yeah, no, that's where my, you know, that's where I'm most interested. You know, those are the types of stories I'm most interested in. And like I said, even the stuff that's not pure horror that I write from a creator-owned standpoint is still going to have some horror aspects to it.
Is there any particular character that you've created in horror that you feel like you connect with more than the others? Like, is there somebody that constantly sort of is sticks in the back of your head as your deepest connection?
Well, I mean, and again, this book is not necessarily a horror book. It's more of a dark fantasy, but there's a character in The Sixth Gun, this guy named Bill John O'Henry, who, much like Bernice in Harrow County, I didn't expect him to be my favorite character, but he quickly became a favorite character of mine. In that book, and I'm awful to him. I mean, he's this poor guy, but I really connect to Bill John O'Henry in The Sixth Gun. He's probably the character. I don't know that I'm necessarily like any of these characters. These, you know, they're all larger than life or have more interesting things or are better human beings than I am. But I like, you know, I like that character quite a bit. And, you know, Bill John and Bernice are both very, you know, our characters I like a lot. But I can see pieces of myself in different characters. There's a character in The Damned named Eddie who just everything he touches turns to crap. You know, he screws up the lives of everyone he's around. And there are times in my life that I've felt that way. You know, and I think that's Eddie speaks to those moments when I feel like I'm just ruining everything for everybody around me. And that's, you know, I think there are bits and pieces. I think this is the case for any writer. There are bits and pieces of myself in all these characters, even the, you know, in many cases, even the villains or the awful characters. Not the guy from Death Follows, though. He's the worst.
No,
he's yeah, just he's terrible.
I would hate to hear you say that you have some kind of connection to Hitch.
That would never be the case.
Okay. With your more recent horror stuff, like I think Dark Ark has been an amazing idea. Also, I want to talk about Unholy Grail really quickly if we can, because that's really fun. I'm interested in what prompted the idea to take those classic heroic tales of Camelot and the Round Table and turn them into a horror story. I've also recently fallen down a huge rabbit hole of learning about old castles in the UK, and they all have some seriously bloody, horrific history. So there's a lot of material there to pull from.
I don't know what inspired Unholy Grail, because I have an old Book of Shadows, which, you know, New Age of bookstores used to sell these journals called, you know, they were, you know, named book, and they, you know, on the cover, it's a Book of Shadows. And the idea was this is where, you know, warlocks and witches could write their spells. And I've always used them as my idea books. I just like writing my ideas in them. And I have this Book of Shadows from 25 years ago that has the first couple of lines of Unholy Grail written in it. And I was going to write it as a novel at one point. I remember that, but I don't know where that came from. I've always been fascinated with you know, stories of Camelot and King Arthur. And I think I just wanted to try something, you know, turning all of that on its ear and approaching it, you know, as if it were a horror story.
I mean, it makes sense if you start learning about those old castles in the UK. It's just like everybody's just constantly killing and murdering and kicking someone in and out of a castle, and it's like families trying to wipe each other out.
It wasn't a pleasant time, and so it's hard to imagine, you know, sort of, you know, knights in shining armor doing, you know, gallant deeds. Sometimes it gets a little tough to imagine.
That's often how they're painted, right?
Yeah,
it's like
and that's, you know, I wanted to tell this story where they, you know, were, it was just a much darker, much more superstitious and just dark version of that story.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really fun. I've been enjoying it a lot. So it's getting late. I'm just going to throw a couple. I've got like two, three more things here from listeners that I want to throw out there before we wrap up. Let's see. JB at Tested Zombie, which is kind of a fun name, said, which one of your independent books do you think reflects you most as accurately as a person?
It's a good question. I would say it's going to be a toss up between Harrow County and The Sixth Gun. Those are the two that I think are most reflective of me, most reflective of the things I love. Show my, you know, I'm showing my love for those books on my sleeve, and they're the books I'm most proud of everything that I've done. Those are the ones that I'm gonna always. There's many of my books I'm proud of, but those two, probably because I was able to tell a long form story and wrap it up the way I wanted to, are always going to be ranked very high for me. And I do think they just are really good reflections of what the kind of stories I want to tell.
My friend Bob Ryer over at Talking Comics podcast wanted me to ask you sort of a silly question.
Oh,
he says, who would win in a no holds barred fight, Edgar Allan Poe or H.P. Lovecraft?
I guess I kind of feel like Poe might win. Although there's going to be a lot of slapping in that fight. I mean, a lot of, like...
not the best dignified fight.
Yeah, it's not going to be a dignified fight. It's going to be a lot of desperate slapping, I think.
And it depends on, like, is it the authors fighting, or are they, like, it would be more fun to sort of have them send their creatures after each other.
Well, then it's going to be a little one-sided. I mean, because...
Yeah, what, yeah, it's true.
You know, Poe has a cat, and,
And a raven.
Oh, okay, a cat and a raven, and Lovecraft has a pantheon of horrible deities that he could.
And then I've got a comment from a good friend of mine. She just wanted to make sure that I said this, but Professor Carolyn Coca, who is the author of Superwomen, Gender, Power, and Representation, wants you to know that Fearless Defenders is how you do female characters right.
Well,
And
that means a lot.
That's something
to me.
Think we talk about it a lot on this show.
Yeah.
Yeah. That means a lot. That book, I when I go to signings and shows, you know, that book was canceled 4-5 years ago. I don't know how long ago it was canceled, but that is a book that I continually get people coming up to me and, make no mistake, it did not sell well. The book didn't do, it did not perform well on, you know, in comic shops, but it meant a great deal to a number of people. And, it's a book that still resonates with a lot of readers. I'm always signing the book, always talking to people about Fearless Defenders, even though, you know, it was not really a successful title in terms of sales. It's a book that, that it spoke to people in a big way. And that's important to me because it was the first book that I, most of the time when you write for Marvel or DC, they come to you and they say, we want you to tell a story about this character, or we want you to do a book called, you know, titled this. Fearless Defenders was the first book that I ever pitched to Marvel that I said, this is the story I want, you know, that I want to tell. And that they actually, you know, that they actually went with. And I'm glad because I think a lot of people, like I said, I think it meant a lot to people. A lot of people still say it was their favorite book. The people that read it, I think, really liked it for the most part, and it's always it's rewarding to me when people say that it was done right or that you know, the character spoke to them. So and it will always be one of my favorite books.
It says a lot, I think, with the way the comics industry is currently changing and how much the bar has been raised for good representation in comics. You know, I think it's great to have something that is as old as that book is and have it still stand up and have someone who, you know, like Carolyn, who's writing a book on good power and representation in comics, to say that that one still holds up as a great example of how to do it.
Yeah, so. Like I said, it means a lot. Like, it's not a book that I would ever say is a perfect book. I think I made a lot of what I would consider sort of rookie mistakes on a superhero team book. But it's always going to be a favorite book of mine for you know, just so many reasons. And the most, you know, the biggest part is that people just, the people who read it and it struck a chord with them and it meant something to them, is always going to make it a favorite book of mine.
Mm-hmm. It's rare.
We definitely appreciate well-written female characters on the show. That's going to wrap up about what we have for you, Colin, unless you have something else that I've forgotten for him before we let him go.
Yeah. Do you feel thoroughly picked?
We picked your brain.
Yeah, I'm satisfied.
I do. I feel very picked.
All the way back to
eight ball. Yes.
Yeah, we pulled out all your skeletons.
Oh, I still got I have a few left that you'll have to research a little deeper to find, but I have a few.
Or we'll just bug you to come back on here in a year and tell us about them.
That's true. Well, that's why I have to keep some secrets. I have to keep some secrets so I can come back.
Here you go.
Thank you so much for giving us your evening, Colin.
No, I really appreciate it.
Sharing all of this
with us.
Had
a great time, guys.
Thank you.
We're going to be very sad to see Harrow County go, but I know that you are one of the busiest people in comics, so you're not going to stop delivering more things to read.
No, that's not in the plan.
Would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you online? Where do you like to be?
Sure.
Sought out.
My favorite social media is Twitter, and it's easy to find me there. It's just at Cullen Bunn. And then you know, I have a website that I probably should keep up to date a little more, but it's cullenbunn.com. Those are my favorite haunts.
Sierra, where can people find you online?
I'm at Sierra Hauk on Twitter and Instagram.
Jackie?
I'm Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram.
You can always find me at Listapunch on Twitter and Instagram. And that's going to wrap up our Cullen Bunn evening. Sirens of Scream is a member of the MegaNerd Media family. You can visit MegaNerdMedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. If you have been enjoying our little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you're listening. We also love being guests on other podcasts. So if you have a cast that you want us to come in and chat with you on, or a suggestion, we're all ears. You can find us at, you can reach us at email at sos@meganerdmedia.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Tumblr, and now Instagram as well, at Sirens of Scream. You can find all our past episodes, show notes, recommendation links, and everything else at sirensofscream.com. And again, Colin, thank you so much for hanging out with us tonight. And this has been really super fun.
Really
awesome show.